Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Michigan's Governor Schneider deploying the National Guard in Flint to help distribute filters to the city's residents, who for over a year have been forced to drink lead-tainted water from the polluted Flint River following cost-cutting measures imposed by the governor. Kurt Guyette, an investigative journalist with the ACLU of Michigan, who was the first reporter to break the story of the Flint River being used as a water supply for the city, joins us to discuss the governor's slow response in acknowledging concerns raised by residents whose complaints were dismissed by his office that also disputed studies that showed a link between elevated levels of lead in children following a switch of the city's water source to the Flint River that these same officials insisted was safe. Then we'll examine the storm in a teacup that the seizure of two U.S. patrol boats by Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps on the eve of President Obama's State of the Union address turned out to be. Now, with today's prompt release of the 10 sailors and their boats, we will contrast yesterday's overheated press coverage and rhetoric from Republican candidates and lawmakers with the quiet personal diplomacy between John Kerry and his Iranian counterpart that settled the matter. Flint Leverett, a professor of international relations at Penn State University who was senior director for Middle East Affairs on the National Security Council, joins us to discuss the value of diplomacy and the need for a deconfliction agreement in the Gulf between the U.S. Navy and the IRGC's Navy. Then finally, following President Obama's warning in his State of the Union address that our politics are drifting to the dark side, heading for what could be an American version of fascism, we will speak with Robert Paxton, the Mellon Professor Emeritus of Social Sciences at Columbia University and author of The Anatomy of Fascism. We will discuss contrast between Donald Trump's manifestation of American celebrity-driven right-wing populism and earlier 20th century versions of fascism in Europe. And joining us now is Kurt Guyette, who is an investigative journalist who heads the Michigan Democracy Watch program with the ACLU of Michigan. He previously worked in Detroit with the Metro Times as an investigative reporter, columnist, and news editor for 18 years. He was the first reporter to break the story of the Flint River being used as a water supply for the city and led the first investigation into the contamination of the water in Flint, Michigan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kurt Guyette.
Thank you very much for having me on. Let me just correct something, though, which in the introduction, I was not the person who broke the story about the switch to use the river. That was a widely publicized thing. My role in this was that we published an internal EPA memo that really formed the basis of everything that's come since then, outlining the role of the river and its high corrosion in sparking this lead problem. So I just wanted to clear that up before we go forward.
Well, thank you, Kurt. And I see a certain analogy here, or at least it seems to me, here in Los Angeles, we at north of the valley in Porter Ranch, there's for several months now, there's been a massive leak of methane that's just blowing out from an uncapped oil well that's been filled with gas, and it has resulted in thousands of residents having to be moved. But it was kept quiet for the longest time. The gas company didn't say anything about it. An enormously slow reaction, and eventually there was an acknowledgement that it was affecting people's health, and schools were closed and children were moved. And it seems to be a case of a kind of callousness on the part of this big corporation in terms of disregard for the health of people in the neighborhood. And there's an equally clear to me that there's a tremendous callousness on the part of at least the governor and his people about what had been going on in Flint for what, since April of 2014. So it's over a year that people were complaining about the water.
Yeah, I guess the one big difference is you sort of expect corporations to try to protect their bottom line by concealing things. Our government is supposed to protect us, not harm us. And that adds an even higher level of outrage to what happened in Flint. You know, the people that were elected to look out for us, people who were appointed to look out for us, didn't happen here. And as a matter of fact, they attempted to cover this up at every step along the way.
So is this a case then, with the echoes, of course, of Watergate, of what did the governor know and when did he know it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because there, part of what's going on here, and it gets a little involved, and I don't want to bore your listeners, but Michigan has the most extreme receivership law in the United States, which allows the governor to appoint what are called emergency managers, and they don't have anything to do with tornadoes and floods and things like that. They're emergency financial managers who, for financially struggling cities and school districts, the governor can come in and appoint somebody that has unlimited power, and the power of elected officials is taken away. The amount that they get paid and whatever authority they do have is bestowed upon them by these emergency managers who can break collective bargaining agreements, eliminate city ordinances, deprive retirees of health care benefits. The only thing that they really can't do, according to the law, is miss a bond payment. So the bottom line is that the bankers need to get paid at all costs, even if that means poisoning a whole town's water supply with lead in a misguided, ill-advised attempt to try to save money by switching to a dangerous water source, which is what happened here. And then when that decision was made and the consequences began to be known, the state, every step along the way, attempted to cover it up and attack the credibility of people who were trying to tell the truth.
And the governor, of course, has deployed the National Guard to hand out water filters. But did he not have a press conference on Monday and where the local residents were shut out? I mean, is he still trying to dodge? Has he really level with the public? Has he level with you, other reporters? I mean, how accessible is this guy?
Well, you know, they have tried to keep me out of these press conferences, saying I'm not a journalist, not a credentialed journalist, and justify keeping me out. But I just saw one statement that he made while touring the Detroit International Auto Show, which he said that he didn't realize that this was really a problem until October of 2015, that he was given misinformation by he didn't specify who. But the fact is that in August, the governor secretly arranged for an anonymous person to pay for 1,500 water filters that were given to a pastor's group in Flint to distribute to poor people there. So the question, one of the questions is, if the governor didn't know until October that there was a lead problem in Flint, how comes he was secretly arranging in August for people to get lead filters or water filters?
Well, but that's, you know, not exactly fixing the problem. That's the problem's already begun once you have lead in your system.
No, the point is that he's claiming that he didn't know it was a problem in October, and right, 3 months before that, he's getting secretly arranging for what people to get water filters. So if it wasn't a problem, how comes he was doing it?
Right.
So the answer is he certainly knew that it was a problem, and he's not telling the truth that he didn't learn until October that it was really a problem.
Yes, but I think an ethical and decent human being with some compassion for his fellow man would have immediately stopped this polluted water. I mean, how complicated would it be to switch back to Lake Huron? And in fact, one of the things that you've uncovered is that they have been lying, the governor's office, saying that that Detroit kicked Flint off the its water supply when that was no such that was not the case.
That's absolutely correct. And the reason for both of those things is that, you know, that they were saying that they were kicked off and didn't have any choice but to use the river water, and their obscenely slow response to allowing Flint to go back to the clean, safe Detroit water that comes from Lake Huron is that the same thing is true for both of those things, which would be that would be them admitting that the decision to use the river water is what caused this problem to explode. And they're trying to avoid culpability that goes along with the decision to use the river water. So that's why they lied when they say they were kicked off of the Detroit system, and that's why they were so slow to admit that the river was what the source of the problem was, because both of those things mean that the people who made that decision are culpable.
Again, I'm speaking with Kurt Guyette, who's an investigative journalist who heads the Michigan Democracy Watch project with the UCLA of Michigan. He previously worked in Detroit with the Metro News as an investigative reporter, columnist, and news editor for 18 years, and he was the first reporter based on memos obtained from the EPA to reveal the nature of the contamination of the water in Flint, Michigan, that residents have been forced to drink since April of 2014. So Michigan is one of two states in the country that where the governor is protected from any freedom of information requests. It's a pretty unusual condition to begin with. So what's getting to this governor and making him act on a problem that he pretended didn't exist? Did the fact that Hillary Clinton recently said, quoting her, "No parent should have to worry that their kids' water isn't safe. We know that a General Motors factory stopped using Flint's water because it was corroding car engine parts."
Right.
That's pretty amazing, isn't it? That something that could corrode metal. Allowing children to drink that kind of water.
Yes, and it was that corrosion that was causing lead to leach into the water. So Capitol was protected, but people were poisoned. And that was back in October of 14 that GM was given special dispensation and allowed to leave the Flint system and return to the Detroit system. But the people of Flint, even though the city council at one point voted to return to Detroit, the appointed emergency manager said, too bad, you're going to keep drinking the Flint River water, whether you like it or not, because you don't have any control here. The state has control, and it's cost too much to go back to Detroit. And because this is a city with 40% of the residents living in poverty and over half the residents are African American, you know, you don't really deserve clean, safe water because you can't afford it. So drink the river water.
But my understanding is that this is also petty, vindictive politics, that the Republicans who control the legislature and the governorship have power in rural Michigan, and they punish the cities like Detroit's bankruptcy was unnecessary, forced on them by Governor Snyder, who put in one of these special managers, and the same thing happened with Flint.
Well, you know, I can't speak to people's motives. All I can speak to is what the outcome of their actions are.
But most of the residents of both Detroit and Flint vote Democrat, don't they?
They're not Democratic voters, right? So they're certainly not afraid of losing votes by doing this. But what's happened here in Michigan is that the cities and school districts being taken over in this emergency management scheme are predominantly African American and predominantly poor. And so racism is part of this. You know, they couldn't get away with doing this in the white suburbs, but they can get away with doing it in cities that are majority African American and poor. And it's certainly a fact that they don't have to worry about losing votes in these cities by taking these actions there. That's for certain.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Kurt Guyette. I appreciate it.
I'm glad you're paying attention to the issue, and I'd be happy to be back anytime you want to follow up on it. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much. And again, I've been speaking with Kurt Guyette, who's an investigative journalist who heads the Michigan Democracy Watch program with the ACLU of Michigan. He previously worked in Detroit with the Metro News as an investigative reporter, columnist, and news editor for 18 years. He was the first reporter based on memos obtained from the EPA to reveal the nature of the contamination of the water in Flint, Michigan, that the residents have been forced to drink since April of 2014. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into the storm in a teacup that the seizure of the two U.S. patrol boats by the Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps turned out to be.
Don't you think it's sad? What's happened to the water? our waters going bare. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Flint Leverett, who's a professor of international affairs at Penn State University. From 1992 to 2003, he served as a senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council and on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran, and his latest book is Going to Tehran, Why America Must Accept the Islamic Republic of Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Flint.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And Flint, the White House is praising successful efforts of Secretary of State John Kerry to defuse this situation, which happened very much on the eve of the president's address. I was watching television yesterday, CNN, and frankly, they were quite hysterical. And they had Senator Tom Cotton on saying that this was a deliberate Iranian act to humiliate the president and how useless Obama was and how evil the regime in Tehran is. And it's all turned out to be a bit of a storm in a teacup.
Yes, it really did. And it says a lot more about the people on our side who are making those kinds of comments than it says about either Iran or the nuclear deal that's been negotiated with Iran. You know, from the time that agreement was announced in July of last year, there have been no shortage of people here in the United States saying that not just it was a flawed agreement, but the Iranians would never keep it. They'll never meet their commitments under this deal. And yet we are literally within probably 2 or 3 days of having the International Atomic Energy Agency certify that Iran has indeed done all of the things it is supposed to do under this deal to reconfigure its nuclear program. And at that point, this deal is going to go, it's going to be implementation day. And, you know, all the people who said Iran would never do this, well, Iran has done this. And you also see, apart from the nuclear deal itself, all of the diplomatic effort that went into negotiating this deal, it has all kinds of other payoffs, as we saw in this episode with the U.S. sailors that entered Iranian territorial waters. If this had happened 2 years ago, you would have had no way for the U.S. Secretary of State to be in immediate and iterative contact, direct communication with the Iranian foreign minister, and for them to work together to resolve this situation and to get these U.S. sailors, back to their comrades within literally a matter of hours. I think Secretary Kerry was actually right on point when he said this is a really powerful demonstration of what diplomacy can actually do.
Well, of course, I suppose with the history with Iran having taken the U.S. diplomats hostage back in 79 for 444 days. And there was an incident a few years back during the Iraq War where yep. British sailors were taken by the IRGC. So there were reasons to wonder, and analysts have often said that there are two Irans. There's the president, in this case, a reformer, Rouhani, and his foreign secretary with whom John Kerry has a personal relationship. on the one hand, and then there's the Revolutionary Guard Corps on the other. How do you see that bifurcation and what happened in this case? Because it sort of indicates, if you read those tea leaves the way that analysts do, that the president, Rouhani, prevailed in this case, overruled the IRGC, if indeed they are, a law unto themselves. They certainly are a navy unto themselves.
I think that Western analysts are really inclined to overstate this bifurcation. I mean, yes, there is definitely, let's call it an ideological spectrum in Iran. It runs a fairly wide gamut. But on something like this, I mean, to do the nuclear deal at all, this wouldn't have been possible in the Iranian system if not just President Rouhani and his foreign minister wanted to do it, but if the supreme leader didn't want to do it, if other important power centers like the Revolutionary Guards didn't want it to happen, it would have been very, very difficult for it to happen. And I think in this situation with the U.S. sailors, I don't think this was an attempt to sabotage the deal on anyone's part on the Iranian side. I mean, these U.S. sailors, probably quite inadvertently and perhaps unwittingly, entered Iranian territorial waters. And they entered those waters near an island where the Revolutionary Guard maintains a military facility. And so these two small vessels were intercepted by Iranian boats, and the crew was taken into custody for a few hours while the Iranians sorted out why these American military personnel had come into their territorial waters. Once it was clear that this was not an attempt by the United States to intrude deliberately upon Iranian interests, the Iranian side, including the Revolutionary Guards, which had taken these U.S. personnel into custody, these guys were released, and there was no, political dissension in Iran, certainly not at high levels, about releasing them. They got intercepted, I think, basically because that was standard operating procedure for the Revolutionary Guards in this particular area of the Persian Gulf. They got intercepted, and then when it was clear that this wasn't an attempt by the United States to intrude upon Iranian interests, the two sides worked it out the way that countries that have, normal diplomatic interactions should be able to work something like this out.
So has anybody really looked into what happened with the U.S. Navy in this case? The idea that a couple of small boats could stray into Iran's waters and create this hysteria. Obviously, the Republicans were full of hyperbole because they've been attacking Obama forever, and this deal with Iran is a real bete noire to them, along with the Affordable Care Act. And they're quite obsessed with it, and they look very foolish now. And as I say, I was trying to follow it yesterday, and the level of coverage was quite hysterical. But still, what remains a mystery, the U.S. sailors are on Iranian television apologizing for their mistake. But the boats, we were told yesterday that maybe one of them went aground or ran out of gas, was disabled. But when they were released this morning, both boats went out under their own power. So maybe they ran out of gas and the Iranians gave them some gas. I don't know. But what's your sense of just the idea, having been in government on the National Security Council, how these tiny little incidents can have so much weight, particularly on the eve of a State of the Union address?
In this case, I have to say, I actually find it easier to understand and decipher Iranian decision-making in this particular episode than I do the decision making on the American side. I don't have any unique information about how those sailors came to enter Iranian territorial waters. You know, some accounts suggest that there was an engine failure. As you said, maybe they ran out of gas. Some reports suggest that maybe there was some kind of failure of navigation equipment on board the boats. I don't know what reality is. It would be truly troubling if the U.S. Navy was deliberately sending its vessels into Iranian territorial waters, especially, as you say, in this particular situation. We'll see what various investigations and reporting turns up over the next few days. But at the moment, I'm inclined to think, probably it seems most likely to me, that this was some sort of accident. Either there was some mechanical failure, mechanical deficiency, a kind of inadvertent human error, that ended up with these boats steering into Iranian territorial waters. And the thing that's, most striking and most positive to me is, as we said, how quickly the two sides were able to engage one another diplomatically in a purposive way and resolve this.
Well, of course, first of all, you mentioned the Atomic Energy Agency. They've arrived to see the dismantling of the Arak heavy water reactor, which can produce plutonium, and that's being disabled. And $100 billion is being released, I believe, on Friday. So obviously, it wouldn't have made a lot of sense for Iran to have made an issue out of this, given that this is apparently an accident. I mean, my question would be, why do we have so much military hardware bumping around in those very congested waterways in a very tense neighborhood when incidents like this could happen? My sense is that we should have a smaller and more cautious footprint. I don't understand how we could be vulnerable to these kind of accidents.
I would agree with you about that. And it raises another question that, this is the kind of thing, I mean, I know personally that, over the last several U.S. administrations, there have been very senior military officers, people who were at the top levels of command in CENTCOM, who wanted to get political authorization from the White House to set up basically the capability for U.S. naval vessels to talk directly to Iranian counterparts in the Persian Gulf, including Revolutionary Guard naval vessels, just in terms of trying to, keep traffic running and avoid these kinds of incidents, or, if there's some kind of collision, one ship into another, keeping that from spinning out of control, just set up the framework so that these kinds of situations could be managed military to military. And, for years, the White House, under both Republican and Democratic administrations, has said, oh, no, you can't talk to the Iranians. I mean, I'm very glad that Secretary Kerry and Dr. Zarif were able to resolve this as diplomats, but I think it would be a very constructive next step if we would also say that, American commanders in the Gulf need to be able to talk to their Iranian counterparts just to work out mechanics in this sort of environment. And I agree with your bigger point. I think we are on the American side, we are sometimes too big, too robust, and a bit too assertive for our own long-term good in the way that we operate in the Persian Gulf.
Well, there's a Pentagon term for this. What we're talking about is called deconfliction.
Exactly. So, exactly. And it is a normal tool of a modern military. And for us to deny ourselves that tool in a situation as potentially tense as the Persian Gulf just seems to me there's no logic for it.
Well, just broadening out the conversation a little, Flint Leverett, to this being a flashpoint, not just the possibility of the U.S. and Iran ships colliding in these congested waterways, but the general increased tensions now between Saudi Arabia and Iran following the Saudis' execution on the day after New Year's Day of the prominent Shia cleric in Saudi Arabia. This was clearly a deliberate act on the part of the Saudis to provoke the very response that they got, which was quite furious, and with the Saudi embassy being burned in Tehran and now ties being broken off. And there's a concern amongst analysts of Saudi Arabia, not that there's a lot of transparency in the way that government operates, that this young king, or the king's son, who's effectively running the country, is out of his depth and was never educated abroad. He's a hardcore Wahhabi, and he's already got the country embroiled in the war in Yemen that's turning into a quagmire, and that this was a kind of reckless act that's pretty much the signature of this young prince. So what's your reading on that?
I think there are increasingly serious questions emerging about the Saudi future. I mean, essentially, Saudi Arabia, it looks more and more like it's steering into this sort of perfect storm where they have, as you say, new leadership, you know, a king who took the throne basically a year ago. He's 80 years old, not always fully functional. Much of the day-to-day running of government is done by this 30-year-old son who's the deputy crown prince. And over the past year, this deputy crown prince, the 30-year-old, with the backing of his father, the king, has, in a way that is literally unprecedented for Saudi Arabia, basically taken, you know, power, which had to a significant degree been dispersed among a cadre of senior princes, a cadre of different factions within the family, as a way of maintaining stability and cohesion at the top. He's basically taken and tried to arrogate almost all power and resources in Saudi Arabia into his own branch of the family. This is causing a kind of unprecedented levels of unhappiness within the royal family itself. And then at the same time, you have mounting economic problems in Saudi Arabia. Basically, this is a country that now has to spend so much on its domestic population to keep them happy that they need a break-even oil price of something around $110 a barrel. And obviously, you know, the price of oil is, to say the least, well below that, and no likelihood of it returning to anything close to those levels in the foreseeable future.
In fact, Flint, it's today hit a record low below.
Went under 30 bucks, which it hasn't done since, I think, 2004.
Right. Well,
Saudi Arabia is facing a set of interrelated crises that look more and more like they're going to come to a head all at the same time, and probably not in the too distant future. So there's some big questions out there about the future of Saudi Arabia.
Well, just in closing, though, I've talked to some of your former colleagues at the CIA, and they say that what they're worried about is a kind of symbiosis here between this kind of spoiled brat running Saudi Arabia and the son of the supreme leader, who's apparently ailing, who's quite ambitious. He's very high up in the Revolutionary Guard Corps. He wants to succeed his father, and that he's in many ways a mirror of the Saudi prince running Saudi Arabia. So could you end up in this very, very volatile region of having the two young, inexperienced leaders who are kind of spoiled brats?
I tend to think that's unlikely, and it's unlikely mainly because of the way the Iranian system works. I mean, in the end, the next supreme leader will be selected after the current leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, is no longer on the scene. There is a system for doing this. It's going to involve, you know, an assembly of senior clerics, you know, more than 80 of them, there'll be other power centers that are kind of informally involved in the process of vetting candidates for the next supreme leader. And I think the odds of someone emerging simply because they were a relative of a previous leader, I think that's actually a really remote kind of outcome in Iran. And so, I don't know who the next leader of Iran will be, obviously, but I really don't think it's very likely to be someone who is young, untested, and someone who, you know, hasn't basically been able to pass through this very systematic kind of selection process.
Well, Flint Liveret, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Flint Liveret, who is a professor of international affairs at Penn State University from 1992 to 2003. He served as senior director for Middle East Affairs at the National Security Council and on the Secretary of State's policy planning staff and as a CIA senior analyst. He left the George W. Bush administration and government service in 2003 because of disagreements about Middle East policy and the conduct of the war on terror. He's the author of Dealing with Tehran, Assessing U.S. Diplomatic Options Towards Iran, and his latest book is Going to Tehran, Why America Must Accept the Islamic Republic of Iran. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into President Obama's warning in his State of the Union address that our politics are drifting to the dark side, heading for what could be an American version of fascism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Paxton, who's the Mellon Professor Emeritus of Social Sciences in the Department of History at Columbia University, where his research focuses on the rise and spread of fascism. His latest book is The Anatomy of Fascism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Paxton.
Thank you for inviting me.
And in the State of the Union speech last night, President Obama implied that there's a threat of fascism, or at least the country could drift in that direction, a drift to the dark side, if I can use the Star Wars analogy. And just to quote him, he said, "As frustration grows, there will be voices urging us to fall back into tribes, to scapegoat fellow citizens who don't look like us or pray like us or vote like we do or share the same background." And most analysts suggest that's a bit of a dig at Donald Trump. How did it strike you?
Well, I certainly understood it as a dig at not only at Trump, but at Cruz and a number of Republican candidates.
And do you think that there's anybody listening, particularly amongst those who support these candidates?
Well, we're told that everyone is enclosed in their own circuit, and they're listening to those programs or looking at those TV programs that they agree with already. It doesn't sound like many minds are being changed either way nowadays to me.
So is that to say then that we have a greater problem perhaps in this country, and that is that there isn't a consensus on what is true anymore, that people do what's called reality shopping? Liberals get their reality from MSNBC, conservatives from Fox Television, Christians from Christian broadcasting. Is that at the heart of the problem, that there's no consensus anymore on what is factual?
Well, I think that's one of the problems. I think it's very serious problem. The country is deeply divided about what's wrong and what should be done about it, and people are listening to their friends and instead of talking to people on the other side to try to find common ground. I do think that's one of the things that's happening. The other thing that seems to be happening is that over a good number of years, maybe 30 years or so, the very idea of what a presidential election is about seems to me has undergone a profound change, and then changed in a very unfortunate direction toward celebrity or stardom. People are supposed to like the candidate rather than think hard about what the candidate might propose to do or how the candidate might run things if he or she were elected. And so there's a shift of the terms of the debate toward liking, toward personality, toward channeling anger, if that's what people want. Therefore, people aren't choosing very well.
But in general, I think it's pretty clear that a lot of Americans are disillusioned with government and with this broken and polarized government. And my understanding from a cursory look at history, that in many ways, disillusionment with democracy is a precursor for a more illiberal form of government, if not fascism itself.
Well, that's certainly what happened in Germany and Italy, in Italy first, and then in Germany when parliamentary systems in those two countries were overthrown and single parties took over and set up dictatorships, and there was a very, very widespread feeling that the existing political system wasn't working and wasn't appropriate for a country of their prestige and power. But it was a whole lot worse than simply feeling disillusioned by politics. I mean, those countries had been, Germany had been defeated, utterly defeated in the greatest war in its history, with 1.5 million dead, and then utterly defeated. Italy had been on the winning side, but had not gotten the peace terms of what it wanted. And then in both countries, there were terrible economic problems, deep depressions. And in Germany in 1929, the depression was deeper there than almost anywhere else, except possibly the U.S. So there was a radical malfunction. I mean, really, really extreme malfunction.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Paxton, who's the Mellon Professor Emeritus of Social Sciences in the Department of History at Columbia University, where his research focuses on the rise and spread of fascism. His latest book is The Anatomy of Fascism. So just to get some definitions correct here, given that the word or the charge fascism is often recklessly thrown around by people both on the left, mostly on the left, but sometimes on the right. I mean, it's often said that Mussolini's version of fascism is the sort of standard, if you will. And it's also said that there's a combination there of a kind of oligarchical power and state control. So is that the sort of combination that we're talking about here? Because the president, in his speech, did talk about the power of money. Just to quote him from the State of Union last night, "Those with money and power will gain greater control over the decisions that could send a young soldier to war or allow another economic disaster or roll back the equal rights and voting rights that generations of Americans have fought, even died, to secure." So just to explain the definition, if you will, and the components of fascism.
Okay, well, Mussolini invented the term fascism, and so he's credited with inventing this type of politics. But Hitler went very much farther with it. But the idea was that you would unite a fractured country by force, if necessary, subordinate individuals to the will of the community, and use this power, this dictatorial authority, to cleanse the nation. There was usually the idea that there were unclean and unsuitable internal enemies inside, who might be Jews, who might be Slavs, who might be immigrants, who might be communists, what have you. And also to use this power to expand the country, if necessary, by aggressive warfare. Now, the oligarchical side, the businessmen, along with everybody else, were subjected to the dictatorship, and they weren't all happy with it, but they were bought off because they were so pleased to have labor unions closed down and the Communist Party shut down that they accepted things like the end of foreign trade and oligarchy and ending of some very profitable international business in favor of working for armaments. And they were well paid for it, and they accepted it. But I think the notion that this represented the takeover of Germany and Italy by businessmen has been proven wrong by historians. The businessmen, it was a second choice for businessmen. They would have rather have had an efficient government that was also internationalist, so that they could continue to trade and sell their goods.
But how much was fascism, particularly in Germany, a way to neutralize or to co-opt and then neutralize the left? After all, Hitler called his party the Nationalist Socialist Party.
Yes, it was the Nationalist. Well, more than that, it was the Nationalist Socialist, National Socialist Workers Party, and it was absolutely designed to destroy the left. I listed a few minutes ago the terrible malfunctions, and one of the explanations, one of the reasons why these parties, which had started out quite small, one of the reasons they developed so rapidly was that they promised to hold off communist revolution. In Germany, 1930, there were two parties growing rapidly, the Nazi Party and the Communist Party, and they fought it out on the streets of Berlin and other cities, and naturally conservatives who were afraid of the communists turned to the Nazis and more or less turned the state over to them in order to get rid of the left, get rid of the Communist Party and the Socialist Party. Italy, same thing. Mussolini was someone who had come from, who had been in the Socialist Party, who chose nationalism instead in 1915, urging Italy to enter the war, which it did, and then used his power to smash unions and crush the Italian Socialist Party, which is how he got his start. He was the most effective weapon against the left, and the left had been very militant after the war, and when a lot of property owners were frightened. That's something we don't really have now. That's not part of the equation. There's lots of things wrong, and lots of people are suffering in America from stagnant wages and from lack of health insurance and so forth. But there's nobody who thinks that the Communist Party is about to take over, which is one of the major reasons why the term fascism doesn't really work terribly well.
Well, given that we don't have that kind of political intensity and street fighting and polarization that leads to violence, we certainly have polarization. But a lot of analysts or those that kind of wring their hands over the Democratic Party's loss of its base, in the sense that my understanding from polls is that a lot of the people that support Donald Trump are white working class men who would otherwise vote Democrat, but find they've given up on the Democratic Party. And, of course, critics on the left always talk about people voting against their own interests without necessarily understanding or analyzing why they do so. So how much is that phenomenon? I mean, there are some, obviously there are some analogies with the 30s, but in terms of what's happening now with Donald Trump, it does seem ironic, is it not, that he's running as a businessman in the party of business, and yet his base support seems to be working-class white men.
Yes, I do believe that's exactly what's happening. I believe that a great many people who have really not done well in the American economy as it has been transformed through the Internet and through high-tech and through all these innovations, a lot of traditional ways of making a living have fallen behind. People without technical skills find it difficult to get a good job or any job at all. For the first time in American history, they fear that they won't be as well off as their parents and perhaps won't own a house. Instead of voting for a party that we would think would be helpful to them, they vote for the party of business, the party of the oligarchy, and that's populism. That's getting people to vote for reasons of ethnic dislike, for reasons of jealousy, for class reasons, moral reasons such as disapproval of homosexuality and of single-sex marriage and so forth. Getting people on the basis of other causes to vote against their own economic interests in order to solidify the economic interests of the people who are paying the vast costs of an election for the right. that is very much what's going on. It's not exactly what went on with fascism, because those parties weren't elected into power. They were co-opted into power by the king and the conservative parties that were already there. Hitler never got a majority, never got more than 37% in a free election. So this is somewhat different. I mean, here are people who could very well get a majority by skewing electoral results, so that people are so angry about about black people getting ahead, about poor people getting relief, so that the lower middle votes against their own interests simply as an expression of anger.
Well, there's some indication that a lot of the supporters of Donald Trump haven't voted before, and you know, there's always been a lot of people who have suggested that, you know, the fact that only at the best 60% of Americans vote in elections is a bit of a disgrace, given how much we tout being the world's greatest democracy. But on the other hand, you know, you have to be careful what you wish for, right?
Yeah.
We don't know how if people were sort of brought out of the woodwork, if you will, you don't know whether they're going to vote left or right in this country, do you?
Absolutely not. Not now, anyway, because political alignments in this country are in a state of flux. Things are shifting very radically. The solid Democratic South disappeared a long time ago. Moderate Republicanism disappeared a long time ago. And as I said at the beginning, people are voting their likes and dislikes on a kind of star system, who seems to them a real celebrity, and also on who voices their frustrations and resentments in the most resounding way, and all of which leads away from rational choices of policies. That seems to be very much what's happening now. Democracy is a wager. You are going to assume that the more people vote, the closer you are to producing a government that corresponds to the popular will. But if the level of knowledge is low and people are mobilized by passions or looking for a celebrity quality rather than what might work best in foreign policy or in tax policy and what have you, then recruiting new voters can turn out very, very strangely.
Well, is that Robert Paxton, a way, though, to suggest that to some extent the media is culpable here? You can certainly make the case that the media oligopolies, the major TV networks, are the beneficiaries of our broken political system, because almost all voters get their information from television ads. And during these election cycles, every 2 to 4 years, the networks make more and more money out of elections. In fact, just recently, the head of CBS was in reference to Donald Trump and these other candidates making outrageous statements. He more or less said, bring it on. We're just making money hand over fist. So, you know, if we have a kind of game show democracy, how much is the media culpable for profiting from our broken system?
Well, I think that some of the things that have gone wrong weren't created by the media, but are the results of our failure, our inability to modernize our Constitution. We should have a single national primary. One of the ways in which the media make a killing is that we have months after months of primary elections in state after state. The process is infinitely prolonged. And that's one reason people aren't voting. It seems absurd and useless. There should also be a single popular election of the president, and the 18th century archaism of the Electoral College, which was initially designed to filter the national vote, and it was designed to go with the system where only property people could vote. That is long overdue for the dustbin, and we should have a single election. And then I think the media would have somewhat fewer opportunities to make money. But we need the media. They're the fourth arm of government. They're how we find out about things. And I think if we had more rational electoral system and less money in politics, the media would be doing its job better.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Robert Paxton, polls indicate that one in five Americans don't trust government. And given the heartburn that the Republican establishment apparently is suffering from Donald Trump and Ted Cruz being at the top of the polls, at least that's what we're told. How much are they culpable, though? The Republican mantra for so long has been to demonize government, going back to Ronald Reagan.
Well, I think that's a kind of stunt that's done a lot of harm. A great many of the people who proclaim loudly that big government is a threat are themselves recipients of government programs in one form or another. There's an enormous amount of hypocrisy here. I think what's happened, and here's where the oligarchy in our case, and I think we're much closer to an oligarchical threat than a fascist threat. What the oligarchy wants is less taxation, no environmental laws, fewer regulations about the workplace so that you can run a coal mine without ceiling supports and without ventilation because you make more money that way. That's what they want, but those goals are hidden and hidden behind concerns that other people feel about that poor people are persuaded to feel about government. That is, that it goes to unworthy people who are not working, people who are on welfare. Apparently, the group most motivated in this way are the people who perhaps had welfare in their youth and they've gotten ahead by their own efforts, and they just don't want other people to be helped with their tax money. That's where the emotions of a lot of relatively poor people coincide with the economic interests of the oligarchy that wants to get rid of environmental laws and labor laws.
Well, just in closing, if Donald Trump were to be elected, and it's looking more and more quite possible that he could be the Republican nominee, would this be the first time in America had a non-traditional president, more in the mold of a Vladimir Putin in Russia or a Erdogan in Turkey?
Well, I think so. If you look back for transitional presidents who were supposed to have broken the mold, you come to Andrew Jackson, who was supposed to be closer to the middle class, closer to the populace, but that's a relatively minor change compared to what this would be. I think this would be utterly and totally unprecedented.
Well, Robert Paxton, I thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Paxton, who's the Mellon Professor Emeritus of Social Sciences in the Department of History at Columbia University, where his research focuses on the rise and spread of fascism. His latest book is The Anatomy of Fascism. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. One more light goes out in the middle.